Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 29th of June, these are our main stories. Joe Biden comes back fighting at a political rally after Thursday night's disastrous TV debate with Donald Trump. Iran goes to the polls to elect a new president after the previous one, Ibrahim Raisi, died in a helicopter crash. The roof of the main airport terminal in the Indian city of Delhi collapses in heavy rain. Also in this podcast, why the famous classical masterpiece Bolero has become the centre of a big copyright battle. For President Biden, Thursday night's televised debate was, even for many Democrats, a dismal performance. But on Friday, he was back on the campaign trail in fighting spirit at a rally in North Carolina. Donald Trump was also addressing his supporters, claiming victory over his rival.
Thank you. Hello, Virginia. Did anybody last night watch a thing called a debate? That was a big one. But as you saw on television last night, we had a big victory against a man that really is looking to destroy our country. He's the worst. He's the most corrupt, the most incompetent president in the history of our country.
After Thursday night's debate, in which Mr. Biden appeared rambling and hesitant, the pressure was on to make a good speech. Many were concerned that his age, 81, remained an issue. But Mr. Biden told his supporters in rally in North Carolina that he could still serve as their commander-in-chief.
I know I'm not a young man. State the obvious. Well, I know. I don't walk as easy as I used to. I don't speak as smoothly as I used to. I don't debate as well as I used to. But I know what I do know. I know how to tell the truth. I know how to get things done. And I know, like millions of Americans know, when you get knocked down, you get back up.
Also in rally was our North America correspondent, Nomia Iqbal. I spoke to her shortly after President Biden gave his speech.
You'd be forgiven for thinking, was that a different man? It was a complete contrast to last night. Perhaps that was intended. He would have woken up this morning to a torrent of bad news headlines suggesting it was over for him. But he directly addressed his debate fail, as many are saying that it was. And he was basically everything that he was criticised for not being last night. He was sharp. He was passionate. He was fiery. He was clear on what he believes is a threat from Donald Trump. I stopped and spoke to a few people afterwards. I mean, the crowd was so raucous. They were cheering him on every moment. And that, of course, helps. There wasn't an audience last night. And they said to me, one man, his name is Corey Branch, a supporter, Raleigh City Council member. He said, we've just got to carry that energy to November. And I said to him, where was that energy yesterday? And he said, well, look, the president had a lot of information in his head. When you know so much and you're so prepared, it's hard to fit in such a short time. He was let loose. And, you know, that was generally the feeling here from a lot of supporters that, OK, it wasn't the best performance that he gave. But they also believe that it was just one performance, does not make him who he is. And he will be fine. That, you know, November, it's a long way to go.
Any theories, though, as to why the performances were so different? I've heard some people say, well, he was using a teleprompter this time, but when he was asked to do it live, it was much harder for him.
I think there's a lot to be said about being in front of a crowd. I mean, he came out to an audience that was just full of applause, full of cheer, just really, really happy for him to be here. I mean, one woman we spoke to said, I think he got some rest last night. So maybe that's why he's a little bit more energised. And he will be well aware of the huge criticism that he's facing, this pressure he's now facing from members of his own party. And he will want to prove that. And he said, to quote him, with my life and soul, I know I can do this job. The threat is too serious. And I think with that sentence, he made it quite clear he's going nowhere.
But can he persuade Americans and Democrats that he is fit enough to be their commander-in-chief for another 4 years, or is this just going to dog him right through till election day?
I think his age will continue to dog him. There's no doubt about that. There is another debate coming up in September. He said he's committed to that. So is Donald Trump. You know, there's an argument to say June, it's a few months away, it's some time, people can forget. But ultimately, you know, it's about turning out the vote and persuading those on the margins and ultimately in swing states like North Carolina, by the way. And I think all that we'll see now is that President Biden will be even more scrutinised.
Nomia Iqbal. From the US, we now turn to Iran, where millions have spent Friday voting in the presidential election there. They're choosing among a tightly controlled list of four candidates loyal to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, to replace Ibrahim Raisi, who was killed in a helicopter crash in May. There's only one reformist in the ballot, Masoud Pezeshkian, a former heart surgeon who's previously criticised Iran's morality police. His campaign rallies attracted growing crowds in the run-up to polling day. These women from Tehran shared their views about the election with the BBC.
I know it's a national duty. I should vote, but I won't. For 45 years, the Islamic Republic has put its own interests ahead of the needs of 80 million who deserve better. Reformists, conservatives, they are all the same. They have done nothing to save people from a sanctioned, crippling economy.
I will be voting for Mr. Pezeshkian. Pezeshkian seems clean. I mean, there are no allegations of corruption against him. He also wants to improve women's rights, and he also wants to improve Iran's relations with the outside world.
I asked G.R. Gold from BBC Persian about the voter turnout.
What we know is more than 61 million Iranians were eligible to vote in this presidential election. Some of the news agencies close to the regime, they say the turnout most likely is something between 39% to 40%. But what we have seen in some areas, almost the polling stations were empty, very unusual in Iran. Don't forget, in Iran in the past, sometimes the turnout could have been 70%, 80%. But this time around, even the supreme leader knows is somehow this like a referendum on legitimacy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, precisely almost 2 years after the mass protest after the killing of Mahsa Jina Amini in Iran. There was a mass protest across the country. Many groups, many political figures, opposition outside of Iran, they called to boycott this election. But obviously inside the country, so many people, their situation is so dire. Some people, they believe really if they vote, something might change the situation. Obviously, there are a group of people also loyal to Islamic Republic of Iran. But we know for sure less than 50% of the population have voted so far.
Are the votes counted fairly?
We don't know it yet. This Iranian election never been fair and transparent. Don't forget, even these four people who are running, they have to be chosen by Guardian Council. The Guardian Council members were being chosen by Supreme Leader. So one person, which they say is reformist, actually, in fact, he's not that reformist. That was the only choice the reformist had. And they were hoping if they vote for him, he might be different than the others.
That was going to be my next question, Mr. Pezeshkian. Is he going to be any different if were he elected?
Well, so far, don't forget, Pezeshkian himself is a heart surgeon. And he has been an MP in the parliament for many years, but openly said he is very loyal to Supreme Leader.
He has to say
he will
that,
be acting
it?
Within his guidance. But what he has said so far is quite different than other candidates who are ultra-right conservative Islamists close to Supreme Leader. He criticized the way they have been dealing with protesters in the street. He criticized imposing Islamic rules on women. He criticized so many policies because of the lack of expert being in a right place. He criticized the system for corruption. So that's why many people inside Iran, they thought if they vote for him, it might be a chance. Something might change. But if those people who are looking at the situation in Iran, they know it is the Supreme Leader and Revolutionary Guards called the shot, not the president.
G.R. Gol. A roof at India's Delhi airport has collapsed following heavy rain and floods, killing one person and injuring four others. Videos online showed huge pillars supporting the roof smashing into cars parked along the airport's Terminal 1. Here's what a passenger had to say.
We just heard that a roof has collapsed and as a result many flights have been cancelled and some have been put on hold. No one is able to tell us what exactly is happening. They're asking us to go to another terminal, but we're not getting any clear information.
Also in Delhi is our correspondent Anbarasan Etirajan.
It came as a big embarrassment for the officials here in Delhi when a section of the roof outside the departure hall in Terminal 1 in Delhi Airport collapsed. Many flights were suspended, and later on the aviation companies, the airline companies, said they were moving their operations to other terminals, which were operating as usual. But now the government has formed a technical committee to find out what went wrong. But if you see the pictures on social media, how these very heavy steel girders just fell down on vehicles waiting outside, trapping many people. And this is also an embarrassment for the governing BJP here, because the entire terminal building, not the roof which collapsed, was refurbished only a few months ago ahead of the elections by Prime Minister Narendra Modi. So this raises questions about audit of safety standards and the quality of construction in India itself for mega projects. But the government says that this section of the roof which collapsed was built around 2008 and 2009 when Congress was in power, which is now in opposition.
I mean, it was heavy rain. There's been lots of floods in India, but roofs like that should not collapse, especially in public buildings like airports. This presumably raises a lot of questions.
India has been on a big drive to double the number of airports and increase air connectivity between the huge cities. You know, this is a vast country, and more people are now travelling by air. That reducing distance. India also wants to rival Dubai and Singapore in terms of air connectivity. In fact, after Mr. Modi came to power, the number of operationalised airports have doubled. The smaller ones have become bigger. So there is a real rush to get this infrastructure up and running. But that also raises the question how far these huge infrastructure projects are being scrutinized and what kind of mechanism to monitor them while they were being constructed. You know, in fact, this morning I saw, last night there was rain, and many of these underpasses in the capital city, a city of 20 million people where the Indian government sits, were flooded. There was chaos of traffic. People were putting pictures, particularly members of parliament. They were saying, now I'm just wading through knee-deep water to get into my car. I even cannot come out of my house because the water has entered the houses. So we are talking about the heart of the capital where these floodwaters have entered houses. So the questions are, what happens about the drainage system? Why they were not even looking into the system when everyone knows these are pre-monsoon rains and monsoon rains are going to come in the next few weeks?
Anbarasan Etirajan. Maurice Ravel's Bolero is perhaps one of the most famous pieces of ballet music in the world. It was an instant hit when it was first performed at the Paris Opera in 1928. And although Ravel died almost a decade later, his heirs earned millions of dollars until the copyright ran out in 2016 and the work passed into the public domain. Now, various interested parties say that Ravel had co-writers on the piece, which would mean it should be back in copyright and earning them royalties. Now, a court in France has ruled that he was indeed the sole writer. Emily Kilpatrick's biography on Maurice Ravel is to be released next year. Johnny Diamond asked her what the copyright row said about the composition.
Bolero itself, funnily enough, was born out of a rights issue because Ravel had originally planned to arrange some music by a Spanish composer. He was all about ready to do this, and then he found that somebody else had the rights to Albanus, and so he couldn't use that, and he was apparently furious. So he said, to a tune that he'd had, an idea that he'd had, and created this work, Bolero. So the work, strangely enough, was born out of a copyright issue, and that's something that stayed with it all its long history.
Did Ravel expect this to be the kind of hit that it became?
Not at all. There's a wonderful story of him talking to the conductor, Ernest Ansermé, who claimed, you know, he found the work wonderful, and Ravel said to him, I can't think why. And there are plenty of other stories like that. He was certainly quite bemused by the fact that this, above all things, was his greatest success. But truly, it is a fabulous tune. There's something that the sinuousness of it, it's sort of simple, but it just tugs at your ears. Ravel Revel, for all that he was self-deprecating about its success, he was on French radio in about 1932, and he talked about walking past a building site the next day and hearing some factory workers whistling his tune. And that was kind of one of his most startling and probably quite satisfying moments in his whole career. What really makes it is this wonderful kind of combination, the tension between the rigorous tune that keeps repeating and repeating. And as the work progresses, more and more sound, more dissonance and tension. So for all of this time he'd been in C major, and suddenly right at the end he slams you into E major and you're just unexpectedly in this new key for a few bars. Tension there, it's unsupportable. It's like the whole weight of the orchestra is pressing on it, and it collapses at the end. And it's this amazing combination of this almost mechanized, like the breakdown of a machine, but it's so human and so sensuous as well. And it's something about that combination that makes it so extraordinary.
Emily Kilpatrick on the beauty of Bolero. Still to come in this podcast.
Previously, one or two kids have a phone, but now most kids have access to a phone. The context overwhelms us. It is difficult to offer them quality of life when there is no food at home, and in this place they offer you 3 meals a day and they're going to give you money on top of that.
The Colombian schoolchildren being lured by rebels on TikTok. In Greek mythology, Pegasus was a winged white stallion, a symbol of poetic inspiration or the soul's immortality. In recent years, though, it's got a grubbier reputation as the name of a notorious Israeli-made spyware that various governments have used to keep tabs, and worse, on journalists, lawyers and political opponents. On Friday, that reputation resurfaced in Poland as MPs voted to lift the immunity of a former deputy justice minister over allegations that he helped buy the software in order to hack the phones of government critics. To find out more, I've been speaking to our correspondent in Warsaw, Adam Easton.
Michał Woś was the deputy justice minister under the previous right-wing law and justice government, which lost power in October's parliamentary elections. And the allegation is that he authorised, as deputy justice minister in 2017, the transfer of more than $6 million from the Justice Fund, which was a fund set up to help the victims of crime. He sent that money to an anti-corruption bureau so they could buy this Israeli-made Pegasus spyware, which the allegations are it was used to hack the phones of hundreds of people, including government critics, including the election campaign chief of the main opposition party then. And now his immunity has been lifted as an MP. He can now be charged. And if he is found guilty of abusing his power, he could face up to 10 years in prison.
What does he say about the allegations?
He says the rubbish, basically. He said, even today, everything I did was absolutely legal, he said. And he would do it again, in fact, he said, because this spyware, he said, was bought to tackle organised crime and catch paedophiles and murderers, was what he said. So he has no regrets at all about his behaviour.
Because that's the thing, isn't it? This software is on sale to governments and its supporters, this is obviously disputed, but its supporters say it can be used completely legitimately. So is this political score settling on the part of the relatively new Polish government, or does it suggest that the previous government broke the bounds of acceptable behaviour?
Well, there are several figures who claim that they have evidence that their phones were hacked during this time. And at the moment, it's the victims who say they were victims, their word against the previous government, who insist that they didn't use it against their critics.
Adam Easton in Warsaw. Fighters from dissident armed groups in Colombia are using TikTok to glorify their lives as guerrillas and recruit youngsters. Their videos seem to offer the promise of money, parties and adventures just a direct message away. Hundreds of comments on TikTok asking how to join show this huge interest. What the videos don't emphasise, however, are the dangers associated with being in an armed guerrilla group. BBC Trending has been investigating. Here's Rochelle Craigier.
The song you're hearing comes from a guerrilla recruitment video on TikTok. Experts have told me that social media has played an important role in luring kids to join these armed groups. In order to research this story, I started by watching only a few dissident videos with my colleague, but since TikTok quickly learns which videos you watch and how much time you spend watching them, soon the app's algorithm was pumping more and more guerrilla videos onto our For You feeds. Some of the TikTok videos we found actively offered jobs, while others showed what they portray as a slice of life inside the guerrillas. Money, cars, guns, women, community, and purpose. They don't emphasize the dangers of being involved in a guerrilla militia. You're about to hear from a woman we're calling Lorena, a teacher from rural Cauca in southwestern Colombia. We're not going to tell you her real name or where she teaches or even use her real voice. Many families in her community know someone who is involved with the dissident armed groups, and speaking out could mean trouble for her and her family.
When I arrived here almost 6 years ago, the children did not dare talk about it so openly in the classroom.
Lorena says a few years ago, her teenage students started sharing social media posts with music glorifying Colombia's dissident guerrilla groups. These are armed groups that didn't like the terms of a peace treaty negotiated between the FARC and the government in 2016. So they kept fighting against the Colombian government and the security forces. Most of them are now grouped in what has been dubbed the Estado Mayor Central, the EMC, or the latest iteration of the FARC. Reportedly, they make their money from illegal businesses. Lorena says at least 15 students from her school left to join the guerrillas.
After the pandemic, it became overwhelming for us. Previously, one or two kids had a phone, but now most kids have access to a phone with the internet, and they're on their cell phone all the time. Unfortunately, one or two start the trend and it becomes fashionable in the classroom.
Lorena says sometimes, after a student has been missing from her class for a couple of days, they suddenly reappear on social media making videos of themselves, wearing battle uniforms, holding rifles, and that's when parents and teachers know they've joined the dissident FARC groups.
I think they do this because they're not aware or they're not trying to be careful. In the end, they're all children and they think it's brave to post something like this. The context overwhelms us. It is difficult to offer them quality of life, give them other opportunities when there is no food at home, and in this place they offer you 3 meals a day and they're going to give you money on top of that.
Even the EMC itself is trying to stop its young members from showing off on TikTok, according to Sebastián Martínez. He's a guerrilla member of the Western Bloc commander Jacobo Arenas of the EMC in Cauca. He has been representing the group in negotiations with the government that have for now stalled.
I first met the FARC when I was just 4 years old, and they taught me how to ride a bike. I saw the work they did in the communities.
We spoke to Sebastián over Zoom. He admitted that EMC FARC make their money from illegal activities like taxing people who have cocaine or poppy crops. I challenged him on whether his group are forcibly recruiting anyone. He says not, but he acknowledges that they do actively recruit boys and girls as young as 15 years old. And when we asked about how the EMC FARC use social media, he said although they will publish certain official statements on different platforms, their recruitment tactics are not based on social media. He doesn't approve of the TikTok some fighters have been posting.
Some comrades, for example, let's say they take a video of themselves that is very pretty because they show how happy they are, but then in that video you show a mountain and you're showing where you are. And intelligence services can say, oh, this person was recruited by a certain commander. And even if that commander doesn't even have TikTok, they are able to find them.
We contacted TikTok for a comment, but we didn't get a reply. However, their community guidelines say, quote, TikTok is not a place to spread beliefs or propaganda that encourage violence or hate. We do not allow the presence of violence and hateful organizations or individuals on our platform.
That report was from Rochelle Craigier, and to hear more on this story, search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts. One of the main issues that puts people off buying electric cars is how long it takes to charge. It can be hours, certainly much longer than the five-minute stop at a petrol station. But a UK company, Niobolt, has come up with a super-fast charging battery that its co-founder, Sai Shiva Reddy, says could be a game-changer.
This is a big milestone for, I believe, the experience as we transition to clean energy. Ultimately, the vision is to get mainstream fast charging possible, and having to wait to charge is a thing of the past.
So how significant is this development? Oliver Conway has been speaking to Zoe Kleinman, our technology editor.
What this company is trying to do is to address what it describes as range anxiety. And that is the kind of fear of how far your electric vehicle will be able to go before you have to charge it. And it's doing that by looking at a battery that can charge extremely quickly. So it's just carried out a test track of its battery. And on the day, it was put inside this very fancy concept sports car. And it managed to charge it from 10% to 80% in 4 minutes and 37 seconds. Now, if you compare that with the existing supercharger, say, that Tesla offers, it does about the same in 15 to 20 minutes, which is still fast, but this is considerably faster. And the idea is to bring it back in line with what you're kind of used to doing when you have to refuel a traditional vehicle.
Yeah, and how have they been able to make it so quick?
There's various tech that's gone on behind the scenes. It's still a lithium ion battery at heart. So we have seen lots of other innovation in this space, because there is a kind of global race, isn't there, to make our batteries more powerful, more durable, and also quicker to recharge. There was some really interesting news from Toyota earlier this year, which claims that it has made a breakthrough in battery tech that will one day enable it to make a battery that can charge in 10 minutes and go for over 1,000 kilometers. But that is using a completely new form of tech. It's called a solid state battery, whereas this battery isn't trying to do something completely new, if you like. It's doing something different with the tech that we already have. And the advantage of that is that obviously a lot of the research is already done, so it can be rolled out a lot more quickly. And also it's compatible with existing super fast chargers. The only issue is that there aren't loads of those around in every country. So there's definitely an infrastructure catch up problem that we have as well. But, you know, there are petrol stations dotted around all main highways, but do they all have chargers, and do they all have super fast chargers that will make people able to get back on the road more quickly? So it's not just a question of changing the battery, it's a question of changing everything that's around it. But I think what Niobolt has demonstrated is this is a rare example of batteries tech leaving the lab, if you like. And they said themselves in the laboratory, they were able to charge the battery from 0 to 100% in 6 minutes. But when they actually got it out and got it into a car and onto a road, there were all kinds of real world conditions that played in. So here in the UK, there was a heat wave, so it was much hotter than it had been. And then there was an issue with a cooling system inside the car they were using. And then they were using a charger that just happened to be there. It wasn't one that they'd built themselves. So, you know, with all of this innovation, you have to bear in mind that when it's actually in your car outside your house, it's not going to necessarily behave as perfectly as it did in the laboratory. But they've described it as a milestone for electrification, which is a very encouraging way of looking at it.
Zoe Kleinman. Before he was an actor, let alone an Oscar-winning one, Russell Crowe was in a band that did regular gigs in pubs and clubs and had a recording contract. At the age of 60, Russell Crowe's career has sort of come full circle, except that the venue for his band's latest gig is one of the biggest and most celebrated in the world, Glastonbury Festival here in the UK. So the actor who is most famous for his roles in the massive hit films Gladiator, A Beautiful Mind and Les Miserables has returned to music. His band Indoor Garden Party play Glastonbury this Saturday, and Paul Henley talked to him while he was en route to the country and about to take off from Rome Airport.
We were on the road last year for about 30 shows, and we knew we were coming back to Italy to do some shows, so I talked to Simon Brand, a promoter, and he said, look, we're going to ask you to play at Glastonbury. It was pretty exciting news. Then we had to sit on that information for about 7 months. We weren't allowed to discuss it or tell anybody because they do their own announcements. So that was kind of torturous. But yeah, it's really exciting. Everybody in the band's really looking forward to it.
And what can people expect at Glastonbury? How would you describe your music?
We sort of touch into gospel, we touch into blues, we do the occasional dirty country song about murder. It's more like a reset for me, man, because this is how I started, you know, like 45 years ago, whatever, this is what I used to do. I used to tour with a band. I've been making feature films for 35 years now, but I've always kept my connection to music and always periodically recorded and released stuff or toured. So it's a pretty natural place for me, man.
What about the baggage associated with being the big movie star?
One or two songs into the set, that just disappears and the whole thing changes. We do get a fair amount of ambulance chases, you know, at our gigs. People that come along and go, well, what's this all about? But, you know, you also got to keep in mind that I've been doing it for such a long time that there are people that have been following everything I've done musically, so they know every word of every song.
Even the cover of your album is your work, isn't it? Just describe it.
Well, it's a photograph of a bloke who was thinking about going for a swim in Woolloomooloo Bay in the middle of winter. And it was quite cold that morning. And he was just stopped there and had a think. And so I took a photograph from behind him. But the way the light was refracting off the water, it's very painterly and beautiful. It just seemed to me to fit with the idea of pros and cons. He's very definitely contemplating what's ahead of him and the temperature of the water.
And he was up for being on the album cover. He gave you his permission, didn't he?
Yeah, it took me about 6 months to see him again, man. So I was getting a bit worried about it because I thought I've definitely got to have at least one conversation with the guy. And then I was on my balcony in Sydney. I've been away, but I just caught up with him around the other side of the bay and had a little chat, and he was quite chuffed to at the thought of being on an album cover.
Russell Crowe. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ricardo McCarthy, and the producer was Rebecca Wood. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.